Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, February 1st. I'm asking you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down the names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's get started with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team here in Santa Cruz is having a restoration on February 3rd and February 10th. I'll announce that one next week. They'll be meeting at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park Saturday at 10 a.m. and to 1 p.m. Linda writes, "We will return to the sand hills of Quail Hollow Ranch County Park and continue our broom bash efforts removing invasive non-native French broom. I will be away part of February, so I'm sending out the next two project reminders today. Chuck Bowman will be the work party leader, and I will see you later in the month. Happy trails." To get to Quail Hollow, take Graham Hill Road north out of Santa Cruz. As you come down the hill into Felton, turn right at the light and drive 2 miles up East Ziani Road. Turn left on Quail Hollow Road, and the park entrance is on the right side, a half a mile up the road. They'll meet you in the gravel parking lot on the left side of the entrance road. Once again, that's this Saturday, February 3rd from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., and next Saturday, February 10th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is an all-volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands in Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Please wear comfortable layered clothing and bring something to drink and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. It's going to be shine this Saturday, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring your gloves and water. If you want more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her phone number, 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. Or send her email at redwoodrn, that's redwdrn, at pacbell.net. Or you could go to the chapter's website, www.cruzcnps.org. That's CRUZCNPS.org. And save the dates. The week of action for the buffalo is coming up. Yellowstone, Montana, and other bison managers have aims to kill upwards of 900 of the gentle giants this winter, all to appease Montana's infamous livestock industry. The country's last wild buffalo, a sacred and keystone species, is our national mammal and are in dire straits, and we must rally together to demand that they are protected and allowed to flourish, not be slaughtered, to satisfy the whims of the cattle industry. February 12th through 18th, join us for a series of gatherings, events, and rallies we have planned for various towns near Yellowstone National Park. February 12th, at the Buffalo Field Campaign headquarters in West Yellowstone, Montana. They're going to kick off the week at camp with a meet-and-greet orientation and a feast before we begin these week's events. And I must tell you that a feast at the Buffalo Field Campaign headquarters is something that I enjoyed. February 13th, they'll be in Gardner, Montana, at the first annual Rosalie Little Thunder Memorial Walk. They'll meet at the Gallatin National Forest Gardner Ranger District Office, 805 Scott Street in Gardner, Montana. February 14th in Bozeman, Montana, they'll have a rally and information table at the Bozeman Library. February 15th, Buffalo Field Campaign Headquarters, they have a national call-in day and day in the field. February 16th, in Helena, Montana, they'll rally at the state capitol from noon to 3 p.m. Saturday the 17th, West Yellowstone, Montana, rally through West Yellowstone. They'll meet at the Buffalo Field Campaign headquarters at 8 for breakfast and 11:30 to carpool to town. meet at Buffalo Spirit at noon. February 18th, another day at the Buffalo Field Campaign Headquarters, gathering, feasting again, trainings and story sharings. If you need more information, go to www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And in Chile, lies, damn lies, and a Mapuche activist have been murdered. In this story from Freedom News, as found on the Earth First Newswire. On the afternoon of Monday, August 22, 2016, Macarena, a Mapuche environmental activist fighting against the construction of a mini hydroelectric dam near her and over her property in Los Rios, was found hanged in her home at age 32. A noose was around her neck, and for the coroner, the situation was obvious. Death by suffocation and hanging, a suicide with a technical explanation that baffled her family. What had actually happened, however, was murder. A doctor was first to explain to loved ones that the key factors for a suicide had not happened. Her cervical vertebra hadn't been broken, and it was clear, explained her father-in-law, Mapuche political leader Marcelino Sacollillo. She had been killed. Most likely it happened in front of her one-year-old child who was with her at the time. It wouldn't be till January 19th of this year, with a trail long cold, that they would have their suspicions confirmed by a government department in a statement that acknowledges Macarena could not have killed herself. She instead had been killed and then hanged to simulate the suicide. And Cambodian forest defenders have been killed after confronting illegal loggers in this story from The Guardian, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Soldiers in an area of northeastern Cambodia where illicit logging and smuggling are rife have reported to have been killed. A forest protection ranger, a military police officer, and a conservation worker in apparent retaliation for their seizure of equipment from illegal loggers, officials have said. K.O. Sofik, a senior environmental official in Mandulkiri province, said the three-person team was attacked late Tuesday afternoon while patrolling in the K.O. Saima Wildlife Conservation Sanctuary. He said the dead civilian was a Cambodian employee of the New York-based Wildlife Conservation Society. The three are the latest victims of an alarming trend in recent years, the murder of environmental defenders by parties seeking the financial exploitation of natural resources. Roughly 200 activists have been killed worldwide in each of the past 2 years, according to the UK-based watchdog group Global Witness. The three were killed not by robbers or a guerrilla group, but they were shot by government armed forces who backed the illegal timber cutting, Sofik said. The conservation team had earlier confiscated chainsaws and motorcycles from some Vietnamese logging illegally, he said. And from Canada, Kwa 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 leaders hand eviction notice to a British Columbia fish farm in this story from CTV News, as found in the Earth First Newswire. Setting out from Port Hardy on Vancouver Island, members of at least six British Columbian First Nations took to the sea Monday to deliver an eviction notice to a fish farm operated by Marine Harvest, one of Canada's largest producers of farmed Atlantic salmon. "This is our right and this is our territory and we need to protect it," organizer and Kwakiutl First Nation elder James Wadhams told CTV News. Like many environmental groups, hereditary chiefs and elders aboard the boat believe that fish farms such as Marine Harvest spread disease and hurt wild salmon. Their symbolic protest was the latest to rock British Columbia's farm fishing industry. Last year, there were demonstrations across the province, and several First Nations groups occupied a handful of aquaculture sites. There was also the release of a shocking video showing blood spewing out of an underwater pipe into the ocean from a farmed Atlantic salmon processing plant near Campbell River, British Columbia. That waste tested positive for piscine reovirus, or PRV, a virus commonly found in farmed salmon that scientists say can easily be spread to wild species. After seeing that video, both the provincial and federal governments launched reviews. Obviously, if there's an appropriate enforcement action that will take place, it will take place, Federal Fisheries Minister Dominique LeBlanc told reporters in November. But despite the ongoing controversy, the industry maintains that nothing is amiss. And from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, we read that 3 abalone poachers have been hit with heavy fines and other penalties. The Mendocino County District Attorney's Office has settled 3 major abalone poaching cases involving Fort Bragg, Sacramento, and Bay Area abalone poachers, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife has announced. 2 of the settled cases resulted in hefty fines and other penalties for restaurant owners. Stephen Yuan Ki Yang, 47, of Fort Bragg, pleaded guilty to federal conspiracy involving the purchase and black market sales of sport-caught abalone for personal profit. Lang, owner of the Asian Buffet restaurant in Fort Bragg, was ordered to serve 360 days in the Mendocino County Jail, was placed on probation for 36 months, and ordered to pay a fine of $15,000. He is prohibited from obtaining a sport or commercial fishing license for the rest of his life. Brent Chu Shu Lee, 44, of Sacramento, pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge of purchasing abalone for black market resale. Lee, owner of the Sushi Cafe in Sacramento, was placed on probation for 36 months and ordered to pay a fine of $40,000. He is also prohibited from obtaining a sport or commercial fishing license for the rest of his life. Lang and Lee were both convicted in late 2017 following a joint investigation by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife Special Operations Unit and the Mendocino Coast Squad that began in June of 2015. In the third case, the strange circumstances surrounding an emergency rescue led to an investigation and eventual conviction. Justin Joffes Adams, 44, of Alameda, California, pled guilty to charges of conspiracy and taking abalone for black market sale. He was ordered to serve 210 days in the Mendocino County Jail, was placed on probation for 36 months, and was ordered to pay a fine of $15,000. He is also prohibited from obtaining a sport or commercial fishing license for the rest of his life. In April of 2017, wildlife officers received information from the Mendocino County Sheriff's Department, Elk Volunteer Fire Department, and Mendocino Volunteer Fire Department about the odd circumstances surrounding a cliff rescue in Elk, Mendocino County. Adams had been dropped off by a friend the day before at the headlands just north of Cuffey's Cove in Elk. He climbed down a steep cliff to the water's edge and harvested abalone during low tide. But when the tide returned, his return route was blocked. When he failed to appear at a predetermined pickup location, a friend called in a missing persons report. Rescuers found Adams stranded on the side of a steep cliff and extracted him around 2 o'clock in the morning. Wildlife officers suspected illegal poaching activity may have factored into Adams' predicament. The day after the rescue, CDFW Lieutenant Joel Hendricks and Warden Don Powers donned wetsuits and swam to the location below where Adams was rescued to look for evidence of poaching. In a deep cut under the bluff directly under the location of Adams' rescue, they found 2 bags containing 38 abalone. One of the bags also contained a half-consumed plastic bottle of water. After obtaining a DNA sample from Adams via a search warrant, they sent the sample and the water bottle to the California Department of Justice Forensics Laboratory, where a DNA match was made to Adams. Trafficking in illegally harvested abalone on the black market continues to pose a significant enforcement problem and further exacerbates the pressure on the abalone population. Black market values will likely increase with the closure of the 2018 sport abalone season in California, but wildlife officers will continue to conduct in-depth investigations and arrest those who continue to poach and commercialize abalone. And a court has overturned a political decision to deny endangered species protection to bison. In this story from the Buffalo Field Campaign, in a fantastic victory, a federal judge ruled yesterday that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service illegally denied Endangered Species Act protections for the Yellowstone National Park bison population. The ruling overturns the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's negative 90-day finding, which concluded that there was not substantial information supporting the need to protect the bison under the Endangered Species Act. In 2016, the bison was officially designated as the national mammal for the United States, Only about 5,000 bison remain in the Yellowstone herds, which constitute the only wild genetically pure bison to continuously occupy their native range in the United States. This is a huge victory, said Buffalo Field Campaign Executive Director Ken Cole. This is a long battle, but we won a significant round for the buffalo today. State and federal agencies have been killing bison in and around Yellowstone National Park in an effort to reduce the imperiled population and cater to the unfounded fears of transmission risk to local livestock operations of brucellosis, a non-native disease brought to the region by livestock. However, a recent study by the National Academy of Sciences found that all of the instances of brucellosis transmission from wildlife to domestic cattle, not a single incident was attributable to bison. The Fish and Wildlife Service made a political decision to suppress and ignore science in order to deny the Yellowstone bison the protection they deserve, said Josh Osher, Montana director for the Western Watersheds Project. The administration is clearly bowing to the influence of the livestock industry and its agenda to minimize bison populations and their natural migrations, despite the status as the national mammal. Court ruled the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service improperly ignored an important scientific study that concluded that there were two separate and genetically distinct herds of bison, the central interior herd and the northern herd in Yellowstone National Park. The current plan treats bison as a single herd, failing to provide safeguards to maintain both herds as distinct and isolated units. Currently, the central interior herd may already be too small to maintain its viability from a genetic standpoint. This is a huge victory that the court recognized the importance of science, says Michael Harris, an attorney with Friends of Animals who argued the case. It sends a signal to the Fish and Wildlife Service that they cannot manipulate the science to serve political interests, such as cattle ranchers. In his ruling, the judge stated if two pieces of scientific evidence conflict, the service must credit the supporting evidence unless the evidence is unreliable, irrelevant, or otherwise unreasonable to credit. This moves bison back into the queue for full and fair consideration under the Endangered Species Act, said Buffalo Field Campaign Executive Director Ken Cole. That's so important for these small subpopulations who are at grave risk of blanking out under the current management. And Sea Shepherd has joined the fight for protecting little penguins in Western Australia in this story from Sea Shepherd Conservation Society Australia. Sea Shepherd Australia has proudly joined forces with the Conservation Council of Western Australia and other local community groups in an effort to protect Western Australia's only colony of little penguins and other marine life from a planned marina, man-made canal, and housing developments on Point Perrone. The vulnerable little penguins rely on the seagrass meadows in Mangles Bay at Point Perrone for feeding as they raise their chicks every year on Penguin Island. Scientists have recorded that there are fewer than 700 breeding pairs left. The state government's planning minister, Rita Sofiati, is now considering a proposal that, if approved, would spell disaster for the little penguins. Sea Shepherd Australia's managing director, Jeff Hansen, who resides in Perth, stated 27 scientists and experts have warned that the little penguins would suffer starvation and habitat loss and could be killed by boat propellers as a result of the canal and marina. Dredging their feeding grounds to make way for a canal, marina, and housing development would be a disaster for Western Australia's only little penguin colony. Western Australia's billion-dollar tourist industry would also feel the impacts, Jeff continued. And here's the weekly update for the Buffalo Field Campaign. No matter the consequence, migration is the way of the wild. She was showing signs of seriously ailing health, skin and bones, and still taking care of a six-month-old calf. Yet she pressed on, her baby never far from her side. The two of them were spotted alone, and then they would meet up with other buffalo, break off again, and finally unite with a family of seven who they stayed with until their dying day. Maybe she was trying to bring her calf to others to care for because she knew her time was still short. Still, she pressed on. In fact, for the week our gardener crew was keeping an eye on her, she was leading the way. For a while, her family was nearly the only buffalo edging towards the danger of Yellowstone's north boundary, but only for a while. The previous week, when we first opened our Gardner camp, close to 200 buffalo were starting to appear, but they'd hang around still inside the park and then be gone again, only to appear in earnest yet another time. Soon more and more buffalo arrived, moving down into the Gardner Basin in multiple groups. Many hung around in the high hills, poised for migration. On one particular day, they began moving to lower elevation, heading north into the basin towards danger. On this day, we counted over 400 buffalo. As we watched them arrive, Bar Marley's exodus was playing movement of the people. Down from the hills they came, such a bittersweet sight. One we should all be celebrating, and in our hearts we were, but we knew what dangers lay ahead for them if they continued on this path. One group of buffalo we were with revealed members of the imperiled central herd. A radio-collared adult female, S3, was there. We'd already seen her and her family on the west side in the Hebgen Basin. They had lost family to hunters over there more than once. But she was proof that the central herd, who migrates both into the Hebgen Basin to the west and the Gardner Basin to the north, are doubly impacted by management actions. In her company, we spotted no less than 5 young bulls, all with stickers on their backs. These young boys must have been some of the quarantine escapees. This group, along with others numbering around 200, were making a beeline towards Yellowstone's north boundary, where multiple hunters waited for them in the Beatty Gulch parking lot. We monitored the herds as they moved further and further north. By the end of that afternoon, as the light began to fade, we were certain that the following day would be one of serious bloodshed. That night, a windy, snow-blown storm came through, and we knew this would cause the buffalo to move even more, and it did, but not as we had expected. The next morning, preparing ourselves for the worst, we headed out to see where all the buffalo had moved to. A sign from a lone bull and the family of 9 led by the ailing mother, we didn't see another single buffalo. Where have we gone? No less than 400 were well on their way the day before, but by morning the basin was nearly empty. We drove south looking for them, seeing no one. It wasn't until we reached one of our high point lookouts off of Jardine Road that we saw the tail end of less than 50 buffalo heading deeper into the park. Something caused them to turn around in the night. Was it the storm? Maybe it was the young bulls who had been tormented in Yellowstone's quarantine facility, warning the others as they got closer to the area of Yellowstone's trap. Regardless of the cause, everyone, buffalo, field campaign hunters, game wardens, and park rangers, were surprised by their exit, some of us heaving huge sighs of relief, others grumbling in frustration. But some of the hunters would not go home empty-handed. The next morning, a family group of 9 were perilously close to Beatty Gulch. No less than 16 rigs full of hunters were in the parking lot watching and waiting for them to cross the line. We waded across the Yellowstone River and watched it all play out. The ailing mama was the first to cross the park boundary. The others seemed hesitant to follow, feeling something was amiss. Not even her calf went with her. The mama was bold, moving over into the parking lot, walking among all the hunters waiting there. Perhaps she was coming to offer herself. Sick as she looked, she would be the one wolves would choose to take. Casting away their hesitation, the rest of the herd eventually followed, walking right down the road in front of all the hunters. Hunters got out of their trucks, started heading up the hill, lining up. The buffalo were still not in a zone where they could be shot. But while it is unlawful for people to move them into a safe zone, hunters were allowed to haze them into areas where they can be shot. And they did. Humans on foot started to surround the buffalo, pushing them closer into the hunt zone. With their tails up, sensing danger, we thought the buffalo might bolt for safety, but they were surrounded. The only place for them to go was directly into the line of fire. Hazers moved them into the hunt zone, and hunters lined up and ready for the first chance open fire. Within a matter of seconds, the family was no more. You get more information at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. In a reversal, the EPA maintains restriction on the Pebble Mine project in Alaska in this story from Reuters. In a surprise move, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency reversed itself last Friday and maintained restrictions on the proposed Pebble Mine, Copper, and Gold Mine project in southwest Alaska's Bristol Bay region. It is my judgment at this time that any mining projects in the region likely pose a risk to the abundant natural resources that exist there, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt said in a statement. President Donald Trump has championed increased domestic mining, and the EPA's decision to maintain restrictions on the Pebble Mine's approval process comes as a surprise. Until we know the full extent of that risk, those natural resources and world-class fisheries deserve the utmost protection, Pruitt said. The Obama administration had blocked the proposed mine in 2014 over environmental concerns, but last year Pruitt started a process to reverse that decision. The Canadian company behind the mine project then applied for a permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. Every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock, you can hear a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow afternoon. That's Friday at 3 p.m. as part of our Environment Friday programming. You could also tune into WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning. KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m. WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California. KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California. KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1 in Berkeley, California, all broadcast the Earth First Update. Check their websites for the date and time. You can always go online to the Grateful Dread Public Radio website. That's GDPRRevolution.com, GDPRRevolution.com, where you can hear the show Sundays at 2 a.m. Central Time. Or you could go to radio4all.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net, where you can listen online or download this or any previous Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It's free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.